People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Today on the program, an ICU doctor challenges the narrative that tents and toxic drug deaths are about mental illness and addiction. We'll hear why Kevin Patterson feels the opioid crisis is rooted in the housing crisis. Plus, we'll pay a visit to Coco Cafe, a social enterprise in Cedar that's creating opportunities and community. Welcome to People First Radio. Opening a recent article, Kevin Patterson evoked the Nanaimo of a few decades ago. What he described sounds in many ways rougher than what you might picture thinking of the community today. A resource economy in decline, unemployment passing 12%, and jokes about Hell's Angels and Nanaimo bars seeming not too far from reality. But the Vancouver Island ICU doctor writes that even as unemployment has fallen and mean income risen, in the center of the city, there is a more visible and abject agony than was seen when unemployment was four times as high. In that article, published in The Walrus, Patterson explored the intersections between the opioid crisis and the housing crisis. He joined me to share more.
Hi, I'm Kevin Patterson. I'm a writer, a novelist, and a doctor.
And you've written about what you call the defining moral failure of our era. Can you tell me what that is?
I think it's the marginalization of the poor, especially as that's expressed in the housing crisis. This phenomenon that's made everybody in North America who owns a house rich in the last 10 years has made it impossible for very poor people to be housed, and that's just ignored, and I think that's a catastrophe.
And you've opened your article on this by writing about Nanaimo's past, and you noted that 30 years ago, as many as 40% of people living here were living below the poverty line, and you also mentioned that unemployment peaked in 2001. What do you think those points illustrate?
Well, the point is that that was a much more economically fraught time. The unemployment rate was 12% or more in the 90s in the course of the collapse of the resource extraction economy. And yet the number of homeless people was much smaller. And this is because rent in constant dollars and house prices in constant dollars was much, much smaller. And it just illustrates how distorted things have gotten, such that in a much more affluent time now, we have many more people who are unhoused.
You've also written that tents catch the eye, but what the public mostly doesn't see is what emergency medical technicians do every day. Can you tell me about that?
Well, my piece is an attempt to explore the relationship between the housing crisis and the overdose crisis. As a physician, I deal with the overdose crisis every day. And my contention is that when a whole body of people are cast out onto the street through economic privation, then it isn't surprising that in that context of dispossession and hopelessness that can attend that kind of existence, that people start to use more drugs. This is not the only thing that drives the overdose crisis, for sure. The majority of people who overdose are housed, but it is a part of it. They're entwined, these two phenomena.
Yeah, that was a major theme of your article, was that these issues of homelessness, housing, substance use addiction, recovery from addiction, mental health, mental illness, they're distinct categories. Someone affected by one won't necessarily be affected by the other. But the big thesis you advance seems to be that if you lose your housing, almost no matter who you are, you're much more vulnerable to be impacted by things like addiction. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think the act of eviction is a catastrophe for people in a way that many people don't ever recover from. You know, once you're out on the street, if you've been employed, you lose your job pretty quickly because, you know, can't maintain the things that are necessary to keep a job up. And, you know, your things get stolen pretty quickly. Regular assaults are a feature of living on the street. It just, things just get worse and worse and worse. And many people never escape that spiral.
And you've talked about how, as a medical practitioner, as a physician, you see the impacts of the overdose crisis, the toxic drug crisis every day. What about that experience? Do you think it's most important that people who don't, aren't on the front lines of it, what do you think they need to know about it?
Well, you know, the response of so much of society to the toxic drug crisis is just one of othering. You know, there's an attempt to dehumanize the addicted people and the people that are subject to the toxic drug crisis. And that is indefensible ethically. Toxic drug overdose has become the number one cause of death for adults under the age of 50, number one cause of death of teenagers. And we just have to embrace this problem and figure out how to solve it. Obvious solutions don't present themselves. People are trying all over the continent. But if we're going to have wars on cancer and wars on tobacco, it's time for us to take the same sort of committed society-wide approach to the toxic drug problem.
And on that front, you've said that there's a prevalent narrative that attributes visible poverty to untreated mental illness, wound around its cause and consequence, addiction. But you've also said that this narrative crumbles after the first few questions. Can you tell me why?
Well, that narrative is handy for comparatively wealthy and unaffected people to hold on to, because it lets us, the rest of us, all off the hook. You know, it's not our fault people are in the street failing. It's because of their mental illness and their own decision to use drugs, and that's extremely handy. And what I'm trying to do is blow that up, because I don't think mental illness is more common now than it was in the 90s. I think what has changed is maldistribution of wealth and power. And the poor are more marginalized now than they've been in 120 years. And that is a consequence of economic and political decisions that empowered people have made.
And one thing that often comes up on discussions of this subject, people bring up this idea of deinstitutionalization. What are your feelings on the impact of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a controversial subject, and it's complicated. I'm not a psychiatrist. I work in an intensive care unit. And what I am certain of is that given the prevalence of serious mental illness, given the impacts it has on society, it's clear to me that mental health resources are drastically underfunded and under-resourced. The number of psychiatrists available outside of all but the major cities is a tiny fraction of what is necessary. Even in the big cities, there are not enough, but there are many fewer per capita everywhere else. And partly this is because of the ongoing stigmatization of mental illness. The mentally ill just do not attract support and telethon funding the way, you know, children with congenital heart disease do, and breast cancer does. And that's because of stigma, I think.
Also on that front, you've talked about the indifference and even hostility of government. Well, I shouldn't say also on that front, but also on the idea of stigma. You talk about the indifference and even hostility of governments, markets, and voters to the unhoused. Can you tell me about how that plays out?
Well, I think the principal manifestation of that is the unavailability of social housing. As a country, we used to build a lot of social housing up until the mid-90s, when Jean Chrétien was doing everything he could to rein in the deficit. And so the federal government got out of the business of building social housing and transferred that responsibility, along with an inadequate amount of money, to the provinces to take over. And so social housing stopped being built about then. And presently, the country is short half a million homes, and the deficit just about exactly works out to the number of homes we would have built if we had maintained our social housing building policies that prevailed up until about 96. So we just stopped doing this thing that was necessary and has grown more necessary. And we haven't taken on this as a priority, even as the number of unhoused people in all the major cities has blossomed dramatically over the last 8 or 9 years.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm speaking with Kevin Patterson, a Vancouver Island ICU doctor and writer. He's recently penned a column published in The Walrus, focusing on the intersections between the opioid crisis and the housing crisis. And you've also talked about the idea of diseases of despair and mentioned that that's not necessarily something the medical system traditionally takes into account. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, this was an idea that was first recognized and explored by some public health physicians in America in a paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, I think in 2016. And what it recognized is after decades and decades of improving life expectancy, the life expectancy in America started to plateau and fall. And the fall was especially marked among middle-aged, non-college-educated white men. And what these authors did is they related it to the dispossession that this demographic experienced with the collapse of the manufacturing industry, especially beginning in the 90s and continuing on subsequently. And the drivers of this decline in life expectancy were suicide, alcoholism, and toxic drug use.
And so on that front, you've written that the least distressed of Vancouver Islanders who are insulated from all of this are inevitably the richest, and they live in Victoria, the provincial capital, where decisions about the allocation of health resources, including mental health resources, are made. What are the consequences of that that you've been able to see?
Well, you know, the maldistribution of wealth and power has a rural-urban gradient as well. And people who live in cities are healthier than people who live outside of them. And the further up island you go from Victoria, the quicker the life expectancy drops. That's been well established for years. And yet there's a significant maldistribution of resources favoring Victoria, and this has been in place for a long time.
And so what can someone do with this knowledge, both what you were just mentioning there and broadly what we've been talking about today?
Well, I think that we have to assign to the housing crisis and the toxic drug crisis the same sort of urgent priority that we ascribe to climate change. It's an existential problem. It's a moral crisis. It's the number one cause of death among young adults. It simply has to be dealt with and recognized, even though, you know, these processes act out on people that might frighten us or alarm us, you know, when they're in the streets and asking for money and whatnot. We have to take this on. And the first thing we have to take on, I think, is the housing crisis. And we just have to build more social housing. And that has to start now. And we have to do something to get their rents down. I make the point that there's all kinds of subsidies in place for homeowners, including the capital gains exemption tax for principal residences, which amounts to billions and billions of dollars of subsidy a year that goes straight into the hands of the wealthiest, you know, the people who own homes. And that is wildly wrong. You know, that some portion, maybe all of that money, should go to the unhoused.
I also wanted to ask, you say that this year in particular, there's been a surge in drug deaths in Nanaimo and that people coming to the hospital are acting differently than people with pure narcotic overdoses usually do. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Well, first of all, the number of drug deaths over the last 10 years has been increasing inexorably, and every year seems to be a spike upon a spike. There's now been since 2012, there's been a 1,000% increase, or a tenfold increase, in the number of toxic drug deaths in BC per year. So that's awful. And for the last several years, adulterants of the opiates, especially fentanyl, have been a feature of what people are experiencing. Other drugs are mixed in with fentanyl that sometimes are neurostimulants and sometimes have dramatic effects on people's bone marrow, and they can compound the toxicity.
And this has been, you mentioned that it's been kind of continually getting worse, but we've seen something new, like a new level of it this year?
Yeah, the death toll for 2023 will significantly exceed that from 2022, that's for sure. And there's been aspects of these toxidromes, of the way people have behaved when they have overdosed, that suggests that there are adulterants in the system. One of them might be a drug called xylazine, but there may be others as well.
And I guess a big takeaway is that today we've really been talking about two distinct but overlapping crises. You mentioned early on in our conversation that most of the people dying from toxic drugs have housing, but you know, we've talked about how you become so much more vulnerable if you do not have housing to the effects of this. I don't know, what for people who aren't involved in this world, who are totally insulated, what is the biggest thing you think it's important to know about maybe the overlap but not complete intersection of these two crises?
Well, they have to be approached in a parallel way, and they both require a lot more resources than they've received. I think the housing crisis is probably easier to address because it's mostly about the fact that we stopped building social housing 20 years ago. And the definitive fix for that, to a considerable extent, is just to resume doing that and to make up the shortfall quickly. The toxic drug crisis is more difficult. You know, experiments with the war on drugs and prohibition have not worked well in the past here or anywhere really in the world. And so dialing that back is going to require a combination of innovation and research that is largely yet to be done. Some of the things that are necessary is more street medicine, more street nursing. We need more health engagement of the dispossessed than there's ever been before. And we just need to take this on with the urgency that the number of deaths generated by it every year demand.
Is there anything else you'd like people to know from your work as a physician in and around Vancouver Island?
Oh, I just would urge everyone, as everybody else who works in this field, and indeed as the BC coroner, Lisa Lapointe, asks us all to do all the time, is to remember that these are human beings, and they're beautiful human beings who suffer and need help. And it's at our own peril that we don't help them. The moral injury of ignoring their despair is great.
Dr. Kevin Patterson, thank you very much for your time, and thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Kevin Patterson is a doctor and a writer. His article, Why the Opioid Crisis is Rooted in the Housing Crisis, is available online in The Walrus.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
Next on the show, we're going to head just south of Nanaimo into the small Vancouver Island community of Cedar. That's where you'll find Coco Cafe. What's Coco Cafe, you ask? Well, let's find out.
My name is Mark Tashiro, and I'm the general manager at the Coco Cafe, which is basically the social enterprise portion of the Cedar Opportunities BC Society.
And can you tell me about what happens at Coco Cafe? What does that mean, social enterprise?
What a great question. Social enterprise is fantastic because what we are, we're a cafe, we're a restaurant. We serve excellent homemade food. Everything here is done from scratch. But at our core, what we do is provide education, training, and socialization opportunities and employment for people of varying abilities. And so we are a profitable business. We just return every penny we make into funding what we do as a charity.
And can you tell me maybe a bit about the history of the cafe? How did it start up?
Well, the cafe started, basically there was a group of parents who had children with developmental disabilities, and they were frustrated by the lack of opportunities for them. And so that's how Coco Cafe was born, basically 12 years ago. And yeah, it's sort of grown exponentially since then. And so at this point, the vast majority of our team are people of varying ability. And so there's only a handful of people who don't fall into that category that kind of make everything run and support what they do on a daily basis. But almost 75% of the team here that you'd run into at any given moment are people of varying ability.
And can you tell me about what the sense of community maybe internally amongst the staff is like?
I think you've experienced a bit of it already. You know, there are other entities that will employ somebody with a disability or a varying ability to some capacity. I think the biggest difference that you'll see is, first of all, when we talk about opportunity, is there a plan in place? Is there a system to grow, to explore their potential and look at and say, hey, what else can we do? Rather than just putting somebody in a job that may not go anywhere. We have the ability to employ people who wouldn't be employable typically in any regard in the open market. And what that does is, when I say that 75% of our team are made up of people of varying abilities, you can imagine any marginalized group put into an environment where they make up the majority of a team all of a sudden feels very engaged. They have the conversations anybody would expect to have in a workplace. They develop friendships. And so it's a very lively, energetic environment. Everybody gets along super well. Everybody supports everyone. And everybody really feels like part of a team.
During my visit to Coco Cafe, I was able to catch up with Jacob and Cecilia, two of the staff members.
My name's Jacob Rockman. I would do here, I was working here since like young and teenager and adult.
And we're also here with?
Cecilia, I'm the support worker here.
And Jacob, can you tell me what it's like working at Coco Cafe?
Well, since I was working here, I love to learn to like cooking and baking, and I love to make some lot of money, I mean. But my favorite is to do baking and cooking with Mark and everything. So that is awesome.
What about barista?
And the barista work is that I did a coffees and tea, and I make the customers happy, not mad, not frustrated. But it's really kind of cool. So yeah.
And do you have maybe a favorite thing to bake or a favorite skill you've picked up?
Yes, this is my favorite. Before, my old recipe is called the banana bread thing recipe. It is so good. It's sugar, but I have to be careful. But the banana bread is good for the customers.
Can you tell us about Brock's brew, maybe?
Yes, I want to talk to you about my Brock's brew. It's like Bieber's coffee name.
How do you make it? Cold brew, right?
It's called cold brew. It's like do it like four with water.
Yep, and then you named it after yourself.
And it's called Brock's Brew, and I want to sell it for the customers. If I should sell it to the customers, then the coffee will be scone. Now I'll make some more.
Oh, it sells out.
What's the, why the name Brock's Brew?
Well, this is my favorite question is that, well, so if this is like Beep's Brew versus Brock's Brew. It's like, well, I named that from Beep's Brew first, and I named that Brock's Brew because my name's Trigger Brockman, but I want to call it like Brock's Brew Coffee.
Beep's Brew, like Justin Bieber?
Yeah.
And can you tell me about the sense of community here? What's it like with the customers and with your coworkers?
Well, the customers, like, I want to talk to them about the weather or funny jokes or something. I make them happy because about the weather or something. If it's snow, then that's kind of dangerous. I mean, yeah.
And what about the folks you work with?
Well, I work with Cecilia, that girl way there. And, well, she makes me laugh, I mean. But I love doing more baking and cooking. Because it's my favorite subject, because it's my plans for my furniture, I mean. Yeah.
What's it like working with Jacob?
Oh, I love working with Jacob. He's so fun to work with.
How has your life changed from before you were working at Coco Cafe to now?
Well, this is kind of different for Cecilia, but actually I didn't know her since before, because... So since, like, I'm very so young before I was working here. So her name is, like, Emma. She's been working here since at the barista. I know her name now, but since now, it's different because I can think and sad because I'm sad because I like her so much. I mean, she's a good friend to me, but... I mean, she's my best friend because we're working together and make laughs and jokes. Fooling around each other is my favorite thing. That's my goals for. But and now she's gone, and now her my difference is that her name is Cecilia. I first met with her, and she's smart and kind and beautiful.
Oh, thanks, Jacob.
But I'm so excited.
What would you like people who don't know anything about Coco Cafe, who've never been here, what would you tell them about it?
So my job is to like making money. I want to have a house, my own, and I'll have a nice girlfriend or wife. I mean, well, for one day, but...
So yeah. Do you mean that like Coco Cafe is helping you achieve your goals maybe?
Yeah, so my goals is like that, like doing a paper with Cecilia, like every shift, I mean, like get ready and focus and make my breakfast at home and ready to go for work, I mean, but then I'll work, like do my morning routine, like saying good morning to Cecilia or my friends first. To start my day, and then sometimes if she's in the office, I'll just say hello or something.
Is there anything else you want to bring to the conversation? Anything else you want people to know? Anything you'd like to say?
Well, I mean, for my fans and my people and family mostly, but I hope they're gonna be awesome.
Thank you so much for taking some time to speak with me.
I'll be honored to.
You're listening to People First Radio. We're paying a visit to Coco Cafe on today's program. It's a social enterprise in the Vancouver Island community of Cedar. Coco Cafe's mission is to provide employment, training, and socialization opportunities for people with developmental disabilities within their community. We just heard from Jacob Brockman, who works at the cafe. I also spoke with his mom, Deborah, about the impact of Coco Cafe.
My name's Deborah Cooper. I'm a fairly new resident to the Vancouver Island area from the mainland originally. I have a son with Down syndrome named Jacob, and I was fortunate enough to be on Vancouver Island and found the Coco Cafe and got involved in their mission here of employing people with diverse abilities. And we've been lucky enough as a family to have Jacob be involved in the process here, and it's made a huge impact on our lives.
Yeah, can you tell me a bit more about what that impact has been?
Sure. Well, you know, Jacob has probably been working here part-time for about 5 years, so we'd come over and visit initially, and he'd spend spring break and summer holidays working a couple of days a week here. And it, at that time, gave him a huge amount of purpose, getting up and getting himself ready for work and feeling like he was contributing. He has three older siblings, and so for him, the world made sense that he would be employed like his brother and sisters were, that he would get a job and get a girlfriend and settle down and get married and all the things that anybody else might expect of their lives. But of course, his life faces a lot more challenges than a typical life. And so this was able to provide a lot of normalcy for him. And in addition to that, it made a huge impact on our family in the sense that if you don't have a child that has developmental disabilities, it's very difficult to understand the context of the value that someone being able to participate in regular society, if that makes any sense. As a parent, there's an overriding concern about where your child is going to end up when you're gone. Are they going to be able to function in their community? Will they have a place? Will people know them? Will they be helped along the way? And this has provided that stability for us as a family, knowing that there is a place here for Jacob. And if it's not here, he's been trained well enough and gone through the process of training that he'd be able to adapt and work somewhere else and get himself to work every day and create a community within that workplace. So that's been hugely important for us.
Yeah, Jacob was talking a bit about some of the skills that he's built here and some of the work he's been doing. Can you tell me about maybe you've seen that at home?
Absolutely. Particularly in the last 2 years, where I think the model of the training here has adapted, and that is that they're really working towards individual potential. And so Jacob's been working in the back, baking banana bread and other baked goods. He's learned how to use the till. He's working as a barista and among other things. And within the last year, he's getting up in the morning and making himself breakfast. So not just a bowl of cereal, he's making himself an omelet. He's making his dad an omelet in the morning. He is completely independent with regard to setting his alarm and getting up and showering and getting ready for work. He's doing his own laundry and folding it and putting it away. And I know maybe for a lot of people that doesn't seem like a big milestone, but it is absolutely huge for us. So he's got a set of jobs that he does at home that he does without being coerced into doing. And he does them effectively and efficiently because he's been doing lots of those types of tasks here. So he understands about doing a job completely and thoroughly and feeling good about the job that he's doing.
Is there something from the model of Coco Cafe that you think more workplaces or businesses or just organizations that exist in society, is there something specific you think that they could take and incorporate to make a positive change?
I think there are a lot of things. I think that where probably general businesses might not be able to do those things is they're not educated in how to make those things happen. So I think it becomes more difficult. There's almost like a fear, you know, we're not sure how to work with people that have developmental disabilities. One of the things I know that is being worked on here at the cafe is the concept of Coco College. And in addition to the training that individual staff members would go through to learn how to do things here at the cafe and learn how to be better contributors in society in general. They're also going to expand into creating an educational component that will target businesses so that business owners could come in and learn how to hire and support diverse abilities people within their own workplace. And I think that's a lot of what's lacking right now. I think that there are incentives to hire people, but there's still an apprehension about it.
Just because there isn't that level of education, or there aren't necessarily those bridges being built such that even if people want to, they just aren't sure how to go about it?
Exactly.
Do you often come in here to the cafe and sit down for a meal or a drink?
Often. We're mostly a to-go family, so we'll grab a coffee to go, or the breakfast sandwiches are our favorite, one of the vegetarian soups we love. So yeah, we tend to come in fairly regularly. And of course, at the end of every one of Jacob's shifts, he's bringing home his next meal. So he loves the food here as well. But yeah, it's great food.
And have you heard from him maybe about the community or like friendships within the staff, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think there is a real camaraderie with the staff. They all know each other. It's a very family feeling environment at the cafe with regard to the co-workers. With the general community, I think there is a real supportive feel. I know in particular there's one gentleman that when I drop Jacob off for work is waiting for Jacob to start work so that he can get his coffee from Jacob. I know that there's lots of people that like to come here because they know they're supporting a cause that's greater than just another coffee shop.
For someone listening right now, just on an individual level, is there something that you would want them to take from just the idea of Coco Cafe and think about and incorporate into their lives?
I think it's mostly that all of these individuals that you may see working at Coco Cafe, or you may see in the grocery store or wherever you happen to be, that have some kind of developmental disability, an intellectual disability, these people, they all are the same as all of us. They all have hopes and dreams. They all have things that they're wanting to do with their future. And I think understanding that that we can help support those things, and we can interact with those people in the same way that we interact with everybody else.
I think that's a big thing you just mentioned there, just the idea of interacting with someone, if just have a normal conversation like you would with anyone else, is the way to do it if you feel sort of in your own head.
Exactly.
Anything else you'd like to bring to the conversation today?
No, other than I think that what I would like to see is a Coco Cafe in every community. I think that there is a need. There are loads and loads of people with diverse abilities that I think aspire to have employment. They desire to be part of a community and to be interacting with their greater community. And I think having those places that they can do that not only helps them, but also helps our community understand more about them as well.
Well, thank you so much for coming in today and taking the time to chat with me.
Yeah, my pleasure.
This is People First Radio. Right now, we're paying a visit to Coco Cafe in the rural Vancouver Island community of Cedar. It's a social enterprise with a mission to provide employment, training, and socialization opportunities for people with developmental disabilities within their community. We just heard from Deborah Cooper, whose son Jacob works at Coco Cafe. We also heard from Jacob a little bit earlier on in the program, and Cecilia, we're going to hear from again right now.
My name is Cecilia, and I'm the support worker here at Coco Cafe.
And can you tell me what that job looks like?
So I work with people with disabilities, and I work with them either baking food or making drinks with them. So like coffee, barista work.
And can you tell me a bit about what is the menu? What kinds of things are you making both on the food and drink side?
Yeah, we make a lot of cookies, loaves. We also work on all our mixes for our muffins and scones every day. We make ham and cheese croissants pretty much every day. And then any type of like espresso drink that you can think of, and drip coffee, things like that.
Can you tell me a bit about the impact that you've seen from doing this work?
I've seen a big impact. I've been here for almost 2 years now, and I can see a change in like pretty much every single supported staff member over the 2 years that I've been here. Jacob, who was on, I've seen huge improvements for him. He's so independent now, and yeah, that's a huge change for him.
And what's the sense of community like, both among the staff and the team, and then the customers who come in?
It's amazing. I'd have to say that this is the like most supportive workplace I've ever been in. And I think that the customers can tell that. And I think that like everyone who's in here is happy. There's hardly ever a day when I come in and people are not happy to be here. So that's amazing to work with.
And what do you think contributes to that? Why do you think that is?
I think that work is just so rewarding for people with disabilities. And I think that it's an area in our society that hasn't really been, like, there aren't a lot of workplaces like this that are so welcoming for people with disabilities, and people want to work. Like, everyone wants to be doing something productive. And so to be able to come into a workplace like this and do something productive, I think the whole community can just feel like how excited people are to be here and to be doing the work that needs to be done.
What would you tell someone who's never heard of Coco Cafe, but is maybe in the Nanaimo area, doesn't get out to Cedar that much? What would you want them to know about this place?
I would want them to know how great of an environment it is, and how amazing our baked goods and our coffee and our food actually is. I think anybody that I talk to that's been here says how great the food is. So not only are you supporting an amazing cause, but you're going to get great food and coffee out of it as well.
Is there something that you think other workplaces can maybe take from the model at Coco Cafe to improve things?
I think every workplace should be open to hiring people with disabilities. I work specifically for NACL, which is a company in town here, in their employment department. And my coworkers are placing other people with disabilities in workplaces, which is amazing work. And I just think that, like, yeah, other workplaces should open their doors to people with disabilities. They want to work. They want to be there. They will show up happy and be super productive.
If you're just tuning in, we're hearing a visit to Coco Cafe in the Vancouver Island community of Cedar. It's a social enterprise that provides employment, training, and socialization opportunities for people with developmental disabilities. I asked General Manager Mark Tashereau about the job paths staff take over the course of their time at the cafe.
We have basically a skills matrix, and we meet weekly and we discuss, you know, who our team members are and where they were at. And somebody may start off with very limited abilities, and they may start off, say, in the dish pit, you know, and we'll teach them the basic skills of washing dishes. And there's several stages to get through that. But once they're showing proficiency, we'll talk to them about exploring other opportunities. So it may be, you know, prepping food in the kitchen, or if they're more social, maybe they want to be up front and try running a till, learning to be a barista. In which case we'll move them on to the next step in the program. And so we have, you know, multiple areas that we can explore with them and develop numerous skills. And, ideally, participants who have a higher level of capacity will end up in the open market working a regular job because they had the opportunity to develop these skills. Not only the physical skills of doing the job, but the socialization skills it takes to be successful in the workplace.
And can you tell me what the response has been from the community outside, the folks who come in here as customers?
You know, we have the best customers. I mean, really, this community is behind this place from the beginning, and we couldn't do it without the community. And every day, you know, yesterday afternoon, we had a local business owner come in and just, you know, tell us how much he appreciated what we do and say him and his wife want to be involved and whatever they can do to help us. And it's that sort of community support that makes it possible, right? But it also keeps people, you know, like this off the street. Because let's face it, when one in two Canadians is living paycheck to paycheck, half our population is basically one paycheck away from being on the street. People with disabilities are much higher risk of ending up homeless. And so we're part of solving that problem.
What can someone do to contribute and help out Coco Cafe if they feel so inclined?
Well, you know what? I mean, you know, we accept donations, but really, come on in, order some food. We do lunch and business catering as well. But yeah, I mean, the best thing that anybody can do is come in and experience the cafe and what it's like to participate in that kind of an inclusive environment, because it's an energy here and understanding that the food is made from scratch from these very same people. I mean, they're showcasing their work every single day.
A couple of people I've spoken with since coming in have talked about a real sense of purpose that they feel like this cafe provides. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's more than just a job for anybody working here, obviously. You know, and this is sort of this Food for Friends program sort of came from that. And that is simply the people here recognize that the community supported them to start with. And so this program that we're running now is actually them donating their own money, their own time to give back to community, giving back to people in need in the community.
Can you tell me more? What is the program?
Well, essentially what we've done is what started out really simply as some of the team members recognizing the opportunity that they have and that others don't, wanting to give back. And after reading an article about how vulnerable people with disabilities are to being homeless, you know, they wanted to do what they could to change. And so we started by, you know, they started donating money and time. So we started putting receipts up for prepaid meals for people in need. And they can just come in, grab a receipt off the bulletin board, bring it up to the register and get a hot meal paid for. That's how it started. The community got involved and started making donations from outside. We've had partners get involved. Obviously, people like the NACL helped make this possible. And so we started making large batches of food, and I go out in the afternoons and actually deliver food to people on the streets. We bring them hot meals and hot coffees to people who just don't have access, can't get here. And then as we push into Christmas, we're actually putting together meals for families in need so that they can actually have a nice turkey dinner and don't have to worry about it. These are hard times. But again, it comes from those very same people. The community supported them. The community showed them they cared. And that's pushing forward and creating more caring going back out into the community.
And from what you're describing, there's a real desire to help and to contribute from everyone involved in this. Is there something that maybe society more generally can take from the idea of Coco Cafe or the way things are done here to kind of spread that around or have that maybe influence more parts of society?
Wow, what a great question. I mean, it's hard because, you know, society has a lot of ails. The systems we've built have their flaws. And we have a lot of people with potential. We just don't necessarily have the avenues to recognize that and to support their development. And I think that's the key to it. And there's lots of great organizations doing great things in different ways. But to me, it is the answer, right? Every time we're able to elevate somebody it allows us to elevate someone else. It gives back to society. It removes a bit of burden from government systems, which allows, you know, money to go back into elevating more people. And so, you know, support for charitable causes is a necessary piece of the machinery that makes our societies work.
How did you get into the Coco Cafe?
I'm a career manager. My degree is in business administration. And in 2018, I actually had an accident and I broke my back. And a single father trying to support himself and his daughters. I was lucky to be able to get a job working remotely from with the government of BC. And while I was doing that, I worked on my master's degree. But I spent, in the beginning, I was lucky to walk 50 steps. And I didn't know that I would ever be fully functional again. And while I was working on my degree, I started thinking about my career and where I wanted to be and what I wanted to be doing. And my daughters were getting older. And that's how I ended up with Coco Cafe, is when I saw the opportunity to work for an entity that gave back to the community, to use my skills, not just to chase a dollar for a corporation, but to improve the lives of other people. I couldn't help but be interested.
Is there anything in the model of Coco Cafe that you would like people to know, to just take into their day-to-day lives as an action they could make or a way of thinking that they could change to make a positive change in the world?
Yeah, I love that. Realistically, I've always lived with the motto that no interaction we have, nothing we do is neutral. Everything, even at the most micro level, makes the world a little better or a little worse. And decisions, where are we going to eat, where are we to buy our cup of coffee, have an impact. That's something that the community here has grabbed onto and held onto with both hands. They come here because they know that they're making a difference in the world. And yeah, it's a simple thing. You're buying a cup of coffee. We're not even asking for a donation. And it's that changes things, right? So every time we support an entity or a business that's giving back to the community, you're making a positive change in the world. We want a better world. That's how we do it. They don't have to be big, grandiose gestures. They're small, simple interactions, but making a choice.
Is there anything else you'd like to bring to the conversation today?
I'd like to thank you for what you do, because bringing awareness is such a huge piece of this. And we all have busy lives, and these aren't necessarily easy times. And the other part is the organizations like the NACL, and we're lucky to have an anonymous funder who helps us as well. But these organizations have an outsized impact on our society and our communities. And so, my appreciation to anybody who's doing anything to help out the community. You're part of the solution. And yeah, I just want to send my thanks to everybody doing that.
Mark Tashiro is general manager of Coco Cafe in Cedar.
People First Radio and Media are Vancouver Island Mental Health Society education and awareness programs.
The BC government has provided an update on a new addictions treatment model that's being piloted in Vancouver. The Road to Recovery initiative was announced in March. The idea is to provide people care along each step of the addiction recovery process, from detox to bed-based care and recovery to outpatient treatment, all with the same care team. 14 detox beds began operating at St. Paul's Hospital in September, with 20 transitional care beds opening in the community the following month. In a video provided by Providence Healthcare, Road to Recovery patient Todd Hogard spoke about his experience with the program.
I came in a lot of pain and with a drug addiction to my, it goes along with my chronic pain. It was injured in 2015 in a car accident, my lower back. I have three herniated discs in my back and gunshot wound in my shoulder. I started using opiates at a younger age for the pain in my shoulder, and I was introduced into heroin when they were cut off, right? So And then I used heroin as a pain relief. And my drug addiction just kind of grew on with that.
What made you decide that you'd really like to be done with it?
I'm just tired of living in pain. I'm so tired of fighting all the time. You know, just, I'm not able to keep up with the standards of life, I guess. You know, I'm always falling behind and up on the street, and then, you know.
Were you living on the street before you came
here? Yeah, I was, yeah. I just said coming in the door that I would give it another shot. Right, so basically that's where I am today. I came into the Rapid Access looking for help, and that same day I was here in a bed. Yeah, which is in itself is something that's entirely new. Right, usually it's call back in a month or call back in a couple weeks, and you know, circumstances change, you don't make that date, or even if you do make that date, you know, you're out of there in 5 days, right? And you don't really, you know, in 5 days, you know, you're kind of just thawing out.
Todd Hogard speaking in a video provided by Providence Health about his experience of the Road to Recovery addiction treatment program that's being piloted in Vancouver. That's all the time we have on the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. A reminder that you can find interviews from the show on our People First Radio podcast feed. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at People First Rad. A big thank you to CHLY, CFUV, and CFMH for playing the show. And thanks to you for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.